folks are born, made to wave the flag. Oh, they're red, white, and blue. But when the band plays Hail to the Chief, they point the cannon right at you. It ain't me, it ain't me, I ain't no senator's son. It ain't me, it ain't me, I ain't no fortunate one.
Yeah, we're not the fortunate sons, and that's a song sung by Todd Snyder. We use it as our introduction to activist radio. We have a little history you didn't learn in high school. We have three stories usually that you haven't seen in the New York Times or on TV either. We also have a couple songs to help you join the resistance during the program. We're at the web, on the web at classwars.org. Take a look at that. You can listen to us a podcast on iTunes any number of ways. You can actually just go to iTunes and search on Activist Radio, or go to Class Wars and click on the date to listen to the program. Our guest today at 5:30 is going to be Doug Rawlings. He's the founding member of Veterans for Peace. He's a poet. He's a critic of the contemporary effort by our government to whitewash the Vietnam story. So we're going to talk about his newest project, a book called Letters to the Wall. So that's going to come around 5:30, so stay tuned for that. Brings me up to the warning, in fact, views and opinions
warning.
This program are not necessarily those of this station, its Board of Trustees, or its constituents, just the views of us, Fred and...
Dr. Trickledown. No, right. No, oh, Eli. Is Dr. Trickledown in the studio?
We'll have to bring him back.
Okay.
He's a big favorite. And we're bringing you up to date on America's hidden class wars.
I'm no fortunate boy. It ain't me, it ain't me, I ain't no fortunate son. There was a big high wall there. You tried to stop me. I saw a sign that said private property. But on the back side, it didn't say nothing. This land was made for you and me.
And of course, that song is This Land Is Your Land by James Isaac. And I just have difficulty saying that. I know we've discussed this, Fred, but when this land is your land. It's not my land. It's not our. It's the Native Americans' land. It's the indigenous people's.
You
but know, in any case.
We ought to find a song that is a Native American song. That and Buffy St. Marie's done a bunch of them. Let's look for another song.
I'm open to that.
All right.
For sure. It just, whenever I hear that,
I know.
My land, your land, our land? No, it is not. But in any case, you can check out our website for a little history of this song. Particularly, well, don't check it out because it's going to be gone soon. So wait till the new song comes
in. We're not that fast, so you got a few weeks to go.
But. Okay. Well, Fred, you are the music maven, so I know you will come up with something just wonderful.
Yeah, you know, we've been doing this 8 or 9 years now. We've changed songs a lot.
Oh, okay.
So maybe it's time for a little change.
Great.
I'd like to do that.
And speaking of change, this is the part of our show, Activist Radio, where we remember the history of social change and social struggle, which is virtually left out of our corporate, let me say that again, our corporate-controlled media. Here we find, we talk about the people who fought for a better world for their children, for their grandchildren, and also, you know, really they fought for a better world for us, and that's you and me. So today's date, September 29th, and Fred will be taking us back to 2002.
And I think, you know, that's what we're really fighting for, too, for our children and our grandchildren. I mean, you know, whatever changes we can make today, it's not really for this year that we're making them. You know, we would like to, you know, make them for the generations to come. I think that's a motivation that I always feel. But
you know, and even beyond that, even if we're not quote unquote successful with the changes, at least there will be some kind of record or
exactly,
some kind of
right.
footnote that says there were people who did speak out, there were people who joined the resistance, there were people who did put themselves on the line and tried to make those changes, even if we're not always successful.
Those poor fools.
Well, you know, they're always there. You know,
they're always
and they
there.
Never get any. You never hear about
them. You
look
back in history; they are there. There, you know, Eugene Debs, he's there. You know, I mean, read Eugene Debs' history, and you get a sense that there's always people willing to fight the establishment for the greater good. And
Then there are people who were there fighting, and you never realized that they were fighting.
Oh,
the woman, the blind Helen Keller.
Helen Keller,
I mean,
right.
She was so radical, and, you know, they just whitewash and greenwash and
yep.
sanitize these people who were just truly, you know, the resistance.
Revolutionary. Yeah, she was a revolutionary. September 29th, 2002, a London crowd estimated between 200,000 and 500,000 protested British and U.S. plans for, quote, a preemptive invasion. That's without provocation and, of course, a war crime that we went ahead and committed with Great Britain as well. Following that huge march, February 15, 2003, there was a coordinated day of protest across the entire world in which people in more than 600 cities marched against the coming Iraq war. Social movement researchers have described the 15th of February protest as, quote, the largest protest event in human history. According to BBC News, between 6 and 11 million people took part in protests in up to 60 countries over the weekend of February 15th and February 16th. Other estimates range from 8 million to 30 million. And although the New York was busy trying to sell the war, and it also claimed there were now two superpowers on the planet, the United States and the worldwide public opinion. I remember that headline. It was so unlike the times to write something like that. The worldwide protests, even though they were covered in the New York Times finally, did not stop the war. And subsequent protests were smaller. And 15 years later, and $3 to $5 trillion later, the U.S. is still occupying Iraq and Afghanistan. We've killed millions in the process. You know, it was probably America's most fruitless and ill-conceived war we've ever fought, and it's still going on. And I'm sort of wondering, the protests were so huge. Why did the protests die after the U.S. invaded Iraq? Or was there a huge failure to maybe organize any other type of resistance to the war once the fighting had begun? I mean, it's sort of left us, both Eli and I were in those marches, and we knew how just amazingly, it was hard to believe how many people were in New York, the one march we had down there, or Washington, just endless, endless groups of people.
There was just the turnout worldwide. I mean, locally here, I know we were involved in things, just the numbers of people that turned. I think it's just two points I wanted to make.
Yeah, go ahead.
First point, we always talk about the Iraq war. It was not a war. It was an attack. It was an invasion. It was an unprovoked attack, which, according to the UN, is a war crime.
Exactly.
It was not a war.
Was.
It was a war crime. And I think people forget that. You know, it almost legitimizes, well, we went to war with them. Is, you know, the implication is there were two equal powers, and they were having a war and, you know, duking it out.
Our war on Grenada, was that a war? I mean, have we ever really fought in a war since the Second World War? I don't think so. I mean, we've invaded any number of countries, and we always call them wars. But I don't think we've ever invaded a country that had the least bit of resistance to our firepower. Maybe Korea. I mean, I don't know. But you know, we have not fought wars.
That's part of that
invasions.
Language.
Absolutely.
You know, the language game and the way it's phrased and the words that are used, it kind of defines the term so that we think, oh, yes, it was, well, the Vietnam War.
Yeah, Vietnam War, right.
This war and, the Iraq War. And they really are not wars.
No.
But just beyond that, Fred, I mean, my sense of it is that huge numbers of people worldwide turned out. And I think it's just kind of symptomatic of the fact when people want something, when the people turn out and express that they want something, like they want clean water, they want good schools, they want good housing, they want good medical care, but we don't get it. We don't get it. Despite the fact that the people want something, we get lead in our water, we get chemicals in our food, we get second-rate medical care. So even though the people are there and they're expressing what they want, there are some really very, very important reasons why we don't get what we want. Well, somebody else wants something else.
One of them is that we all got on the bus and went home and picked up our trash and went on the buses and went home. I mean, there wasn't grassroots organizing that followed up on these things. And I think it proves to me that the grassroots organizing is probably more important than the huge demonstrations. I mean... Nixon had grassroots organizing that he was fearful of, and those huge demonstrations made him nervous about escalating the war, and he said that over and over in his tapes. But George Bush just took another vacation and didn't really care at all. I think it's the organizations, I would say radical organizations, that should have followed and didn't. You know, we didn't create grassroots organizations working for in anti-war change.
And of course, once Obama got in, everybody kind of went to sleep. You know, it's Obama. He's going to do all the right things.
Yeah.
And of course,
not to go
into his record or his history, but it's just been a catastrophe.
Yeah, catastrophe for war. Well, we're going to do a quick song on war. Of course, we're going to go back to a couple people we knew when they were young. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And the album is CSNY, Deja Vu, and that was a live album. And the song, of course, is Living with War. Let's hear it.
I take a hold.
They Lied by Jay Mankita. This is the lead into the next part of our show, Fantasyland Media. We do have a website. It's called fantasylandmedia.org. Check it out. They Lied. Oh my goodness, do they lie? Our media. This is where we take a look at the failings of our corporate-controlled, corporate-owned media, where all the news is fashioned by the people in charge, the corporations, and your own government. Each week, we cover the stories that are just left out of the U.S. propaganda machine. And what a machine it is. My goodness. First story this week comes to us from Times Warp. Billions with a B in taxpayer money to Israel. How the New York Times hides unsavory facts from view. Thanks to American taxpayers, that's you and me, folks, Israel has been receiving $3.1 billion in direct military aid every year, and under a new agreement signed this week, that amount is set to rise to $3.8 billion of tax money annually to Israel. This is a hefty package and major news, but the New York Times has been oddly reticent about it, running a story on page 6 of the print edition and without fanfare online. This is not a new phenomenon at the Times. Over the past year, as the United States and Israel have negotiated a new 10-year memorandum of understanding concerning military aid, readers have seen few references to this topic. And even with the signing of a new agreement this week, the newspaper maintains its minimalist approach. The article by Peter Baker and Julie Hirschfield Davis, gives few details of the deal, instead providing a great deal of space to the state of United States-Israeli relations. In addition, donations sent by Jewish and Christian groups here in the United States to support the illegal settlements are tax-exempt. So every dollar donated to support the colonization, and might I say brutalization, of Palestinian land means the loss of at least 20 cents on the dollar that should be going to the United States Treasury. Hiding the truth about Israel has always been a priority at the New York Times. Often the newspaper is little more than a propaganda vehicle for Israeli occupation and apartheid.
That's a nice site. That's where I got this Times Warp. It just follows New York Times reporting on Israel. So it's really interesting stuff. And before I get into our next story, I just wanted to take a look at the Miscellany News. You know, that's the campus newspaper. And since we're broadcasting right in the middle of Vassar College.
Yes, we are.
I'm going to ask why the President's Office Dialogue and Engagement Across Differences Fund, what a mouthful for a fund, brought in a person, a Wall Street journalist, a columnist, Brett Stevens, who talks endlessly about how the U.S. should support Israel because they're so LGBTQ friendly.
Really?
That's the oldest, most discredited argument, and makes LGBT people furious as well. Gay washing is what it's called. Now, why does the president feel, well, this is Hill who did it and she's gone now, but why would she feel that she had to present something sort of so distorted and so intellectually discredited? Wouldn't that discredit the college to have something presented like that? It just is discouraging.
If I had to guess, I would say there are some heavy contributors and heavy supporters to the funds here at Vassar who put pressure on her to put as positive a spin as they can on Israel's image these days, which has been tarnished in so many ways.
Yeah, there's big
money.
And
it's under, I don't want to say attack, but there are serious questions being asked about Israeli policies and occupation and destroying, demolition of homes and starving the people in Gaza. It doesn't look good for Israel.
Yeah. And the second one, the story, is about Jill Stein.
Dr. Jill Stein.
Dr. Jill Stein, Harvard-educated, actually, Dr. Jill Stein, calling her a potential serial killer. Wow, that is, even though the author goes on to even apologize for saying that, why does she write that anyway? and I think this whole issue about being against vaccine is something that's conjured up by the Democrats. Really, if you do look into it, you will see that she is questioning the role of the pharmaceutical companies in the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. She's questioning corporate decisions that affect what vaccines we get. She's not criticizing the vaccines. So, you know, this is, again, pretty mindless to be putting this in a newspaper and calling somebody a fascist and not really doing the legwork to see that this is just a Democratic ploy.
It's outrageous. It's inflammatory.
Yeah, really.
It's provocative. And it's just disingenuous. I actually heard Dr. Stein, she was doing kind of a town hall, and a pediatrician in the audience stood up and asked her and said, well, why are you against vaccines, Dr. Stein? And Dr. Stein, she went on to explain, number one, that she's written a textbook on vaccines, and she is not against vaccines. She has some questions about the scheduling of when the kids get them and if that's appropriate. But I personally am against vaccines, but Jill Stein is not.
Mm. So anyway, there's our campus peak at the campus.
Peak at
Miscellany News peak. Next story, national story. From Common Dreams, backing up the Standing Rock Sioux and its allies, the United Nations expert has called on the United States to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. Echoing pipeline opponents' concerns, a statement from the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, this is Victoria Taul-Karpuz, cited the pipeline's threats to drinking water and sacred sites. She also admonished the U.S. for failing to protect the protesters' rights and failing to properly consult with communities affected by the fossil fuel infrastructure. Quote, the tribe was denied access to information and excluded from consultations at the planning stage of the project, and environmental assessments failed to disclose the presence and proximity of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. This, again, is the rapporteur stating, just 2 days before Standing Rock Chairman David Archimald had targeted the UN Human Rights Council to help the tribe stop the pipeline. Responding to the crackdown on the pipeline protesters, she said the U.S. authorities should fully protect and facilitate the right to freedom of peaceful assembly by indigenous people, which plays a key role in empowering their ability to claim other rights. So UN rapporteur telling the U.S., you know, you're not acting appropriately with the Dakota Access Pipeline. You'd think that that would make the New York Times, but it didn't. No word yet. I think the Times sometimes backs down and carries a story like this, but so far they haven't. I think it's because elite business interests want this pipeline, desperately want the pipeline, and our media really just usually falls in line according to what the rich corporations want and omits a story like this.
Well, the fossil fuel industry has so much power in
Incredible.
Terms of money,
yeah.
lobbyists, contributions to campaigns, so much influence. The media is part of that corporate elite, so of course they're not going to report on it. And also, just as far as the United Nations, you know, the rapporteur for the United Nations, they've been wanting to come in here and investigate the prisons in the United States
exactly,
because
right.
they view them as being torture chambers. But of course, the United States basically says, you know, kiss my you know what, you're not getting into our prison. So, you know, the United States has such a strange view of the UN. You know, we listen when we want to hear what they want to say, but when we don't want to hear what they have to say, we just block them right out and
right.
just don't give them any credence whatsoever.
And then people don't hear about it in the U.S. anyway.
Okay. Do we have time for our,
sure.
our third
we'll
story?
Jump right in there.
And I just want to mention also that the Standing Rock situation with that Dakota Access Pipeline, there's something so reminiscent about the kind of brutal treatment that the Native Americans are receiving now. It's almost like, I'm not going to say it's a direct repetition, but the way they've been marginalized and dehumanized and just that their voices don't count, their rights don't count, and this pipeline, they're just going right ahead. They just keep digging
oh, yeah.
and digging and
yeah,
digging. They haven't really stopped, despite the fact that President Obama gave it some lip service and say, well, you know, we've got to listen to the indigenous peoples. But they're just digging away. And, you know, this stuff, it's just the most horrible contamination. It's filthy tar sands oil. It's just such a threat to the health and well-being of everyone in those regions.
Contaminate all their drinking water. I mean, they won't have any water. So I hope it'll turn out that maybe we do some long-distance reporting. Eli will be out in the Dakotas, and we'll be calling in for
My
the
wife
program.
Is insisting that I go. She
I,
says,
I'm
I better,
gonna,
I
I'm
just
gonna
better get out of
it.
Town. And,
gonna,
oh, Fred, you're joining in on this, too. Did I... I have to leave the.
I'll
leave
buy
the
you
area.
A tank of gas. That'll get you about
all these incentives.
A third of the
I think all of our listeners, we should get some kind of a fund going that you know,
That's
so
right.
I can get there in style.
Our reporter
on Activist the scene.
Radio. All right.
Oh my goodness!
All right,
got the wheels spinning here. Anyway, our last story today comes to us from the Electronic Intifada. Editors at two of the most widely read Palestinian online publications have had their Facebook's accounts disabled. Administrators to the Facebook pages of Quds, which has more than 5 million likes, and Shehab News Agency, which has more than 6 million, found they could not access their accounts on Friday. Ez al-Din al-Haras, a supervisor at Quds, told the Electronic Intifada that at around 2 p.m., three of the publication's editors found their accounts disabled. The same thing has happened to five editors at Shehab News Agency. A news editor for that publication told the Electronic Intifada. Both believe that the suspensions are directly related to an agreement between Facebook that's Facebook, and the Israeli government to collaborate in monitoring what Israel claims is incitement by Palestinians. The joint Facebook-Israeli censorship efforts, needless to say, will be directed at Arabs, Muslims, and Palestinians who oppose Israeli occupation. The Intercept's Glenn Greenwald wrote of the agreement earlier this month. Well, how long will readers of the New York Times wait for this story to be printed? I guess it wasn't printed, and sadly, the New York Times, it doesn't cover free speech issues that involve Palestinians. So yeah. I guess
or Muslims either.
We're just going to let, you know, Facebook and the Israeli government decide to censor the truth, basically.
Sweet deals with the Israeli government. The Facebook, I think, I've always thought that was really one of the worst, but they're... You know, they always seem to be compromising themselves to, you know, the Chinese or the Israelis. But I think this is such a bad example of how Facebook would use their influence and power to curtail Palestinian rights.
And they go beyond that, too. I know that the folks out at that North Dakota Access Pipeline, there's a fellow named Tiokas and Ghost Horse. His stuff is regularly taken off
of
the social media. Yeah, he's regularly censored, and stuff is just not allowed to get out there. And, you know, it harkens back to what we say at the beginning of the show, Fred. It's this corporate-controlled media.
Yeah.
You know, we get the propaganda. If, you know, if it agrees with that, with their scenario of what the world as they know it should look like, it's fine. But if you're, you know, if you're a Palestinian or you're Native American or you're Black Lives Matter or you're someone out on the edges,
right.
You ain't going to get that same access.
It's really what we worried that the internet would become, you know, it was incredibly freeing, and it still is in so many ways. But the major corporations have really gotten their claws into it. We're going to actually go right to our guest so that we are able to play the whole interview. This is Doug Rawlings. He's the founding member of Veterans for Peace. I'm going to put some of his poetry on our blog, Class Wars blog. He's also a very vocal critic of the efforts by our government to whitewash the Vietnam story. And he's going to talk about his latest project, Letters to the Wall, where people write letters to individuals or groups on the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C., and they leave the letters just by the wall, and at night they pick these letters up. And so he has several years of letters to choose from. You can't read too many of those letters without really getting into the absolute insanity of the Vietnam War and the incredible price that American servicemen had to pay for fighting in a war like that. But let's talk to him about Letters to the Wall. Hold on.
All right. Well, welcome to Activist Radio. I've been looking forward to this interview for a while. We have a lot in common. We were in the Army, Doug, at the same time, pretty much at the same time, although I wasn't sent to Vietnam as you were. And I notice in some of your writings you refer to becoming a peace activist in Vietnam, and I thought maybe for our listeners that would be interesting to know how you become a peace activist in the middle of a war. And how did that happen for you?
Well, first of all, Fred, thanks very much for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And I was looking at your website, which I think is absolutely terrific. Okay, so I was drafted out of graduate school in 1968. I was down at Ohio State working on my MBA. And I ended up in Vietnam in July of 69 with the 715th Artillery and in the Central Highlands of Vietnam working with the 173rd Airborne. And I was on. I started off being on a landing zone, and then went to. We built a fire base, which is different than the fire bases that people are used to seeing now, I suppose. So this was just a, you know, concertina wire sandbags and.
Right. Right. Yep. Well, something that we probably know from the movies. Actually, yeah. As we go along. If you, I don't know if you can adjust the volume on your phone. It's a little low for the recording.
Okay. Yeah, how's that? Is that better?
Yeah, that's better.
I'm sorry. Okay,
great.
So So I was in Vietnam from July of 69 to August of 70 with the 715th Artillery in the Central Highlands, and I was on a firebase in a landing zone, and our job, if you will, was to provide artillery support from the 173rd Airborne. So when I got there, I was already 22 years old. I was not some 19-year-old kid, didn't know what's going on. I kind of knew what was going on, but I really didn't. And when I was able to engage to some extent with some of the Vietnamese villagers, I came to a very quick realization. And with this 50 years later, this sounds like really stupidly naive. But at that time, I really didn't know what the score was. But when I started meeting Vietnamese people, I didn't speak their language, they didn't speak mine, so it was just, very perfunctory. But I realized fairly quickly that we were brutalizing these people for no end to benefit them in any way, right? And that's the beginning of my peace activism. And again, it sounds 50 years later, it sounds to me it's really incredibly trite, but I began to realize that we were causing great harm to the world and the military. I was part of that. And I kind of made a pledge to myself that I would work as hard as I could to stop that war if I get out of it alive. I did stuff like silly stuff like wearing a black armband, which you're in this place where the highest ranking officer is this major, and he's got he's overlord of all of us, and we're all walking around with M16s and M79s and just heavily armed. In kind of a crazed frame of mind, tell you the truth. Doing that was sort of like, you're out of uniform. And I would say, well, yeah, what? And they would walk away. This is the beginning of what they call the, in retrospect, we see it as the beginning of the mutiny of the troops in Vietnam.
Yeah, that's a story.
Right.
I'm beginning to realize. Well, actually, what prompted this is I last year took a look at the New York State exhibit on the Vietnam War. It's up in Albany, one of the state buildings. And they, it's a sizable exhibit, and it got all sorts of, weaponry, helmets, and some poetry, But what is missing is how the war started, like why we invaded that country, and also missing is the end, like that we had to leave. And I looked over and over at the end of the exhibit, the fact that we eventually had to pull our troops out because we really had no prospect for ever winning. In other words, those two such important pieces were left out of that. So I thought to myself, the lie is still continuing. And,
absolutely, yeah, by design.
I guess my question is, why is the lie so important?
Well, this is why we started the full disclosure movement that we started, because, Obama has devoted $5 million a year for the next 12 years, to telling the history of the Vietnam War. And if you look at the phrasing of it, and you look at how the Pentagon set up their website, they're making a myth of the war, and they're not telling the full truth. And so, you could say, well, okay, who cares, right? I mean, it's over with, it's done, we got to look forward, all that kind of stuff. Why should we listen to these old guys like myself about this? But it's the design, we think, is so that they can justify that war and make that war a noble cause. Then future wars similar to it can also be given that same kind of thing. And, and what they're focusing on, and the insidious thing for me is they're treating me as a Vietnam veteran as one of their tools, because they're saying, well, thank them now, right? Give them the gratitude you didn't give them in the 60s, right? Well, screw that, right? no way in hell am I going to be used that way. And that's what they're doing, right? They're trying to convince young people that it was a good cause. And if you talk to young people about the war, it's like talking to me about World War II back when I was, college age or something like that. There's so much stuff out there that these kids are being fed, and that's what we decided to do. So, if we had anything to say about that Albany display, we would have pointed out how, as I was beginning to say, in 69 and 70 and 71, one of the reasons that they pulled out of that war was they realized that soldiers were saying, there's no way in hell am I going to lose my life for this cause, which, you know, who knows what it is, right? And so there were beginning to be, you know, just teeny little cases of what can be referred to as mutinies, people refusing in the field to go out on particular missions. And it was happening
more
and more and more.
Whitewashing of the war, yeah, that the mutiny is never ever mentioned as a possibility.
Right.
And I don't, do you know that Noam Chomsky, I should have looked it up exactly his quote, but he said in something like 1973 or 1974 that the Vietnam War is over. The next war is the war for the American mind. Figure out what the war did. And, you know, he really adequately predicted that, you know, that this country would spend years and years and years trying to glorify something that,
right,
if you were in it or near it like myself, you know, you realize that there was no, there's no glory there. I mean, it's just exercise in brutality. What prompted you to become interested in letters that were left at the wall at the memorial, the Vietnam memorial.
The letters that we deliver. So we started this full disclosure movement when we read the Pentagon's website, and we said, mm-hmm, okay, we've got to counter that with something. So we have this VietnamFullDisclosure.org website, which is really excellent, and it's really driven by two people in North Carolina in particular, Howie Machtinger and Julie Dobson.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to it, it's really quite interesting. It's got many, many different articles in it all the time, being revitalized almost on a daily basis with all kinds of stuff.
We're going to link to that, by the way, at Activist Radio.
Cool.
So people and listeners can go there.
But for example, you know, if we have a counter timeline, right? And in the month of November, September of 1966, right, the 50th commemoration anniversary, what we're in right now, there's a little point on our timeline. It says on September 23rd, the Pentagon admits to using defoliants in the jungles around the demilitarized zone. Mm. Well, that's the first acknowledgement of using Agent Orange, right, which we've all come to know and despise. It's horrible. That's the kind of stuff we're putting into our timeline to counter what what they're trying to tell us about that war. So so we started this full disclosure thing, and we've done a number of teach-ins and talks and things like this, and they came up with the idea, why don't we put out a plea to people, anybody who has been directly impacted by the Vietnam War, to write a letter to the wall itself, to the soldiers who died in the war. And we will deliver those letters on Memorial Day. And we've done last two Memorial Days. We've delivered 298 letters and 32 postcards. And we do it at, very precisely, you know, at 10:30 in the morning on Memorial Day. We gather at either end of the wall, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, and put these letters at the foot of the wall. Mm. And on outside of the letters is a very strong statement that says, please read me. Because if you've been to the wall, when people leave stuff at the wall, they're usually quite personal, and nobody really picks them up, right?
Uh-huh.
But we're saying, pick these letters up and read them, all right?
Mm.
Which people do. We stand back and watch. It's amazing. And then the National Park Service collects everything that's left at the wall and puts it into their archival work warehouse.
Uh-huh.
And they contacted me 2 weeks after we had done this and said, can we put some of these letters out for public display? We said, absolutely. And many of them are written by people who have come to the conclusion that the war was immoral, unjust, and just downright stupid, really. But the letters are quite moving. And they're letters written by guys who were there, nurses who were there, daughters and sons of people whose names are on the wall, granddaughter, a beautiful letter from a granddaughter whose grandfather was killed in the war, all kinds of different things. People who were anti-war resistors, who went to Canada, guys who deserted, you know, left the military, all these letters are part of this collection. And so we're doing it now.
They're amazing letters, and we talked a little bit about putting some of these letters on the Activist Radio blog so our listeners could read the letters. Plus, we'll put links to where the letters are located. Are the letters located at fulldisclosure.org?
Some of them are. Yeah, some of them were, because when we got and started getting them over these 2 years, we did that. But what we did, what we decided to do was put out a book of 158 of these letters, which we're selling at, you know, I think we're selling $12 a pop now. It's a 350-page book with photographs of delivering the letters to the wall and stuff like that. It's quite moving. You know, I can say that as the editor of it, right? You know, one of the editors of it.
There's no doubt that in the second, by the second paragraph of reading some of these letters, you are definitely, I find, I'm just hooked into the emotional impact of a granddaughter writing her grandfather. I mean,
it's a beautiful,
just a profound impact. What's the name of the book?
It's called Letters to the Wall. Memorial Day 2015-2016.
Great.
And it's veterans, and you can go, if you go to our website, you can get it. It's also available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Great.
Eventually, but you'll pay more money by going to them than if you go to our our website. You can get it for $12. They're going to sell it for $18,
right.
I think. So.
Yeah. What have you learned from reading the letters? I mean, you and I are both in the service pretty much the same time, and I was in Korea. We learned a tremendous amount about life. Both of us were a little too old for the service. I was 24 when I went in. You were, what, 22? Or 22.
Yeah.
But I learned a tremendous amount about U.S. occupation, you know, in Korea and what the military was all about. And I'm sure you learned so much during your service, but what did these letters show you that you didn't know before?
Let me say it reinforces something that I have become to realize over the years, that the gap between those who fought against the war and those who fought in it is narrowing. You know, over these years now, it's not like, you know, when we go to D.C. and we set up this amazing display when we deliver these letters to the wall, by the way, right across from the Lincoln Memorial, we've got this huge bell tower, we call it, full of statements from people about war. And so we're there, and in this last Memorial Day, we were there when Donald Trump was there, and he set up a big thing, and they brought in this Rolling Thunder group, motorcyclists, mostly a lot of non-vets, with their heavy leathers and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And usually known as, you know, pretty right wing and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so they're there, right? You know, in force. And we're there too. And I'm passing out brochures to these guys and their leathers and stuff. There were 100,000 of them, by the way, on motorcycles, Harleys, right? And that's quite a sound. But anyways, you know, there's kind of like a, you know, hesitancy as we approach each other, like looking, you know, this guy looks obviously somebody who's different than me politically. And very quickly, we engage in a conversation that's got a common theme to it, which is this war sucked, right? You know, it really did, right? And for whatever reason, now some people might hold on to the belief that, oh, well, if we were given more armaments, we could have won the war, quote unquote.
Right.
You know, and my response to that is, you know, define to me about what winning a war looks like. First of all, nobody wins a war at all. And secondly, you know, we dumped more armaments on that country than all of World War II, period.
Yeah.
So, you know, short of dropping nuclear bombs, you know, that's a myth that we should. And so we quickly cut through that kind of stuff, and we talk about, you know, our experiences. And pretty soon, you know, we're either hugging or shaking hands or doing something, right, to indicate that we've got this commonality now, you know.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, like we've got people in our group right now, in Veterans for Peace associate members, who were part of the Weather Underground fighting against the war while we were there, meeting with Vietnamese people in Montreal, by the way, in 1969, right? I find it stunning. So we're together in this whole thing, right? And I can't say we've come to any peace about what we've been through, but we come to the realization that working together is a much more important thing than, you know, battling over with minor differences.
And I think almost anybody could agree that keeping America's young from wasting their lives in some foreign war, imperial war of empire, you know, if we can keep people from sacrificing their lives for absolutely nothing, That would be meaningful. I think that that's something that I got out of the service, that, you know, I would always be working, you know, against the U.S. military machine. I mean, I would certainly, as most vets say, would protect my country if it was ever invaded. But, you know, marching across the world, I think we have 800 U.S. bases all across the world. That's not protecting a country.
No. But, you know, I volunteer at our state Veterans Administration Hospital here in Maine. I go once a week, and I work in the psychiatric ward with patients, and I do we do readings of poetry and stuff like that. And the last couple of sessions, I brought excerpts from this book, you know. And a lot of these guys are they're in this ward, obviously for some pretty severe reasons.
Sure,
and at least half of them are Afghan and Iraq War veterans, right? You know, and I'm sharing this book about the Vietnam Wall, and it cuts right through time, right? It's like everybody's got that same kind of feeling about this stuff. And then guys start talking about Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, and like we talk about Vietnam, you know, and it's like, Jesus Christ, when is this ever going to end? When is this stuff ever going to stop? You know, and these and some of these guys are very much thinking, you know, that they've served the people, which I don't even like that word anymore. So, you know, we're not politically on the same page, but emotionally, you know, I would say spiritually we are.
Right.
And, you know, and it's this whole, this notion of what we call moral injury comes to play, too. You know, it's not, you know, it's not like PTSD is so widely used now. It's almost become a cliche, right?
Sure.
You have to be really careful about somebody saying they got PTSD. Well, you know, where that comes from. But moral
injury. Soldier's heart, right? What the
Civil War
veterans called it, soldier's heart. But
yeah,
I want to thank you so much, Doug. That was really moving, and we'll put some poetry and some letters on the Activist Radio blog as well. And I'll let you know right before this plays, and keep up your wonderful work. That's just so important for all the generations of Americans. So thank you so much for
everything
on.
You do. Yeah.
All right.
My honor.
Thanks, Doug.
Take care.
Take it easy.
Yeah,
bye.
You too. Bye.
Well, that was just as moving as it was to do that interview. I mean,
well, he certainly had a great energy and great insight and his experience, and you could just hear it in his voice. And I think one of the most important things that he was pointing out, this whole idea of whitewashing Vietnam and kind of reconfiguring the story and making it some kind of a myth, is so important to keep all these myths and ideas about the empire so that the American people are really kept in the dark about the truth.
Yeah.
And it just covers every part, you know, whether it's the media. I actually just saw a movie the other day. I think the title was London is Falling or London is Under Siege with Morgan Freeman. But it was basically London being under a terrorist attack.
Hmm.
And, of course, the good old American forces, the president is there, and he's got his Secret Service guy, and they're killing Arabs and they're killing terrorists. And it is just the most blatant propaganda to demonize dark-skinned Arab people and to make such heroes. I mean, this Secret Service guy, he's slaughtering and killing and, you know, with the wisecracks and the comments. And then he goes home and he's loving his little baby and his wife. They're just all the cliches about we're so wonderful and we do everything that's so great and we're fighting these unhuman beasts who are out to kill us. And it's just such sheer propaganda, Fred. I mean, it was really disgusting and disturbing to see it.
I think we are such a far-flung empire that has committed innumerable war crimes since the Second World War, that the propaganda really has to be strong in our own country to keep the people in line, to keep them sacrificing their sons and daughters, to keep them paying for these multi-trillion dollar wars where they can't afford to send their kids to college, they don't have health care, they don't have jobs. You know, to keep the empire running, you need a really strong propaganda machine. And I think that's what we've seen emerging here, that it's the empire that creates the propaganda machine because it has to. Because the people would just say, we're not fighting anymore.
Like, and they also realized that, you know, with the draft, all the guys who were drafted, they knew it was a lot of nonsense.
Sure.
And you always talk about the lie. Well, today we've got a paid military.
Yeah.
We've got a paid mercenary military who buy into all of the, you know, all of the flag waving stuff, which is so powerful. I can even feel myself going for that. You know, when the flag is waving and the Blue Angels or whatever, they're flying over and the flag goes up and the national anthem. I mean, that patriotism and that nationalism is so powerful.
It doesn't ever get me. I don't know, but maybe that's being in the military. I just put that in a category that I'd like to flush down the toilet.
Yeah.
Because I think so much of it is lies, based on lies of why we're there. And I think that's servicemen. I think I've said this a couple times before. That's one of the things that bother war veterans most of all, to hear the lies that they believed and resulted in them going and killing people, and then in the end to find out that they were lies. I mean, that is the betrayal that I think is so incredibly damaging, to wreck your life by taking another person's life and then realizing that you've done it, you know, for a lie. But anyway, we're going to go out with Pete Seeger, The Soothing Melodies of Pete Seeger.
All right.
Listen to Activist Radio on WVKR 91.3 FM, broadcasting from Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. We're on the air every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. live from our website, classwars.org. Be sure to like Activist Radio on our Facebook page and check out our Class Wars blog for some behind-the-scenes commentary on today's interview. Stay tuned for Mark and Radio Eclectica coming right up. We'll be returning next week at the same time to help you become part of the resistance.